Hey everybody, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question or comment for us, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Without further ado, grab yourself a cup of coffee and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. You know, it's the start of Mental Health Awareness Month, Dave. We're kind of taking a couple of episodes in a different direction, but
yes, we are,
and in a very necessary direction. I'm going to say excited about this series, but I don't mean I'm excited to talk about people's problems, but I'm excited to bring this out to people because I think these are topics that are difficult to talk about. They're topics that, you know, a lot of people probably think about, maybe recognize signs in themselves, recognize signs in their coworkers. So, you know, it's probably going to be a deep couple of episodes. But
this is kind of what we set out to do, right? We set out to talk about issues that affect technicians, and what is affecting technicians a lot lately is mental health issues. So, I mean, other than COVID right now, that's affecting us.
Well, but that plays into
It definitely does. Yeah.
I mean, I know, you know, those of us that are still working emergency every day and, you know, having those patients incoming, and, you know, that just adds another layer of stress and all of the protocol changes and everything else. So I think we'll try and maybe in some ways leave that out of it, just because these are otherwise issues that I think have been going on for several years. Yeah. But also, you know, with the understanding that that stuff at least ties in, if not exacerbates, you know, a lot of these issues for some people. So what do you think? You got a good cup of coffee down there?
I do. You know what I have?
I do. You know, I was just before I worked a shift this morning, and I stopped at the grocery store on my way home, and I went down the coffee aisle just to see if there was anything interesting. And I kid you not, the very first label that caught my eye was Folgers Black Silk.
Yep. That's my coffee.
It's like, I maybe just need to buy a bag of that and send it to Dave.
I mean, because it's pretty good. It's good stuff.
I have actually Molly made a pot this morning of our breakfast blend, which is just, I mean, it's just black coffee, but it's like a bold flavor to it.
And I like the bold. That's what Black Silk, it's bold yet smooth.
And the good news is, unlike, you know, we recorded an episode last night, unlike that, I don't have to be up at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. I don't have to be at work till 1 o'clock. So I have regular caffeinated coffee tonight.
There you go.
And I am very excited about it. So what else is going on down there? I know you've got a lot going on with Avectin applications. You're chairing that committee this year.
I took over that job from you, and you didn't tell me how much was involved. So
there's somebody else you're going to hand it off to in the future. Don't say too much.
But that's a couple years from now. They're not going to know by it. They're not going to look back and think of this.
Yeah. How are your students doing?
My students are doing good. They're a little bit frustrated being remote. It's getting a little bit hard for them. You know, we're getting down towards, this week 5 of our 10-week term. So we're supposed to be back in school on the 4th of May. So, well, I guess this episode is dropping much later than that. So we will know if we've gone back to school. But, you know, the concern right now is all the labs and all the skills things that I wanted to teach them in this term. You know, are we going to run out of time and not have time to do that? So, you know, we'll have to see where we are in a couple of weeks if that's actually going to happen.
Yeah. From a teacher standpoint, maybe even an administration standpoint, I mean, that's about 2 weeks away.
Yep.
So it's not like that's a decision that can be made, you know, 2 or 3 days in advance and just expect everybody to, you know, just pick up where they are. I mean, you know, I would imagine in the next 2 or 3 days, they'll have a, we're still sticking with May 4th, or no, we're going to extend it until such and such, I would guess.
They may decide it like at last minute, because, I mean, what's the big change? We go back to doing what we were used to doing.
I guess all the students are used to it. So maybe it's not that big of a deal.
I don't think it'll be that different. And right now, all my syllabi have been changed or altered to show that we're going to be back on campus on this date. So if we go back on campus that date, then I'm already ready to go. But if we're not going back on that date, then we have to make some decisions of what are we going to do here.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Yep.
That's all we can do.
All in the name of adjustment. And
yeah.
And hopefully, maybe you'll learn something cool that the school can take forward from here on out. And
hopefully,
somewhere in there, it's something useful and not just, you know, been a waste of a couple of months in terms of going back to just the way that it was.
Yeah.
You know, I think the same thing with Tufts. Like, what are we learning during this time that we can apply to when we go back to normal?
Right.
And as Noah said a couple episodes ago, I'm doing the air quotes, because in normal in terms of actual caseload, right? In terms of all the services, surgery, doing surgery and everything else, like once our caseload gets back to normal, have we learned anything now that we could apply then?
And
just
the contact with people, is that going to change once we get back into this, like what is going to be the new normal?
Right. Well, what do you think? You want to get rolling?
Let's get rolling. Let's bring them out.
No, it's we got some big episodes coming up, and this is going to be the first in a series for May. And for our listeners, again, given this is the first episode of the series, if you're not familiar, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Dave and I kind of wanted to do a series. The way that the rotation fell, we were going to have 3 episodes this month anyway. We thought we would just solely focus on mental health issues. So we have some compassion fatigue stuff. We have some depression stuff. Heavy episodes. But the reality is, especially, you know, Dave, I think about your students who maybe now are experiencing some of this stuff all the way up to where you and I are. I mean, a big part of starting this podcast was because we kind of both were at this career crossroads where we were kind of like, not happy what I'm doing right now. And, you know, I'm starting to see some signs in myself that I'm not happy with. And that's what we're here to talk about. So I'm really excited for our first guest because I know he deals a lot with this from, I'm going to say, a managerial standpoint. And that's not necessarily what I mean in terms of like a hospital manager, but in terms of helping people through some of these issues. So our guest for this episode is Joe DeFulio. Really excited to have him. He currently serves as the Vice President of Clinical Services for MedVet and is the co-owner of East Coast Veterinary Education. And if that name sounds familiar, one of our previous guests, Liza Rudolph, is the other co-owner of that. He's held varying roles within the veterinary industry since 2007. He's a CVT, a compassion fatigue educator, and a certified compassion fatigue professional, and we'll ask him exactly what those mean and what those do. The majority of his clinical experience as a credentialed technician has been in emergency medicine. Respect. And when not working, Joe enjoys sharing knowledge through lecturing, traveling, exploring new cities. I mean, we see him all the time at conferences, which of course largely has been on hold. And we were saying before we came on air that, you know, he's gone from so much traveling to doing everything remote. So we'll talk a little bit about that too, and visiting his family on the East Coast. So Joe, thank you so much for being with us today, taking some time out. Can we get you a cup of coffee?
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. It's great to be here. I would love coffee. I'm like a coffee addict.
You've come to the right place.
I'm pretty basic, so I do flavored coffee. So like French vanilla coffee with a little bit of half and half would be great.
You are speaking my language. You lost me at the half and half, but I do love French vanilla.
We do have some French vanilla and creamer that we have in the house.
Yes, so we'll press that right up.
We'll put that in.
So we kind of always start with career path. And, you know, going back to when you kind of first started in this field to where you are now and some of those additional certifications you've gained along the way and maybe kind of focus some of your attention towards the compassion fatigue, if you don't mind just kind of taking us through some of that. And then we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So like many others, you know, if I look back 10 years, this is probably not where I ever thought I would be or what I would be doing. You know, veterinary medicine is actually the field, a field that I never thought I was going to go into. In full transparency, I needed volunteer hours for a high school program. And I went into a local veterinary hospital and, you know, I thought what everyone else thought. I was going to play with puppies and kitties and do all that kind of fun stuff. And boy, was I mistaken. I did not know everything that happened behind the scenes, but it was really eye-opening. And that's really where I made the decision that this was my calling and what I wanted to do long-term. So I started at that practice. You know, while I was still in high school, I worked every weekend as a kennel assistant, walking the dogs, cleaning, doing laundry. A lot of things that are really important to the function of the hospital, but I think sometimes we kind of overlook them. But So I started there, and then I continued growing with that practice, learning some more technical skills, and really grew there. And that's when I found my passion for emergency medicine. Emergency would walk through the door, and you'd see the people that would like run in the complete opposite direction.
Right,
of it.
Yeah.
and I'd be the one running towards it. So, you know, I thought that that was maybe my calling. So shortly thereafter, I moved to a 24-hour hospital in New Jersey. It was kind of a hybrid practice, so it had a GP, a 24-hour ER, and some specialties there as well. And it was really a one-stop shop because they had like grooming, doggy daycare, and boarding all at the same facility. So it was like everything all in one. And I worked in emergency medicine as a credential technician there for quite some time. You know, trauma, toxicities, they were all the things that brought me a lot of excitement in that role. And then I really took a turn down the leadership path, which is, again, not at all where I expected myself to be. It started off with making a schedule. So whoever was leading the team, they decided to take a different role and someone needed to make the ER team schedule. And as you know, many people don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
having done that myself, yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
I wish somebody would touch that with a 10-foot pole at Tufts right now.
Count me out. So I started making the schedule, and then from there, they really identified a need within the ER for some leadership, mainly for overnight ER. So, you know, I thought long and hard about it, and I knew that it would change a lot of my relationships that I had established with my colleagues, and it did. So I stepped into the role. I admittedly lost some friends along the way.
Sure.
But I did find that, you know, the most loyal ones were the ones that were able to really separate out personal and professional, and, you know, I still am connected with many of those today. This is where I started one of my long-term work relationships with Liza, was at this very practice. So
Oh, wow. We
were able to separate that out and continue moving forward. You know, as things progressed, there was another manager. We kind of had a co-management dynamic where that other individual managed GP and specialty, and I managed ER. She decided to move forward with another opportunity, and they combined the roles into one and explored if I was interested in it. And, you know, I had a little bit of angst about it. It was a big role, and mine was not getting backfilled, so it was just moving two things into one. I took the plunge into it, and, you know, it didn't come without challenges, and I think it's a very great topic for tonight, really around mental health and prioritizing that, which I didn't do a great job of, admittedly. And then as I continued growing with that practice, eventually the practice management role came open, where I was able to oversee the nursing staff for the hospital and then also the day-to-day operations. And I was in that role for a fair amount of time until an opportunity came up in Ohio. And in full disclosure, if you asked me several years ago if I'd ever be living in Ohio, the answer would be absolutely not. When I flew out here for the interview, I thought it was going to be all like cows and farmland, and I didn't really know what to expect. But, you know, I'm here and I really like it now. It's much different than I expected. And I'm currently based in Columbus. I lived in Cincinnati for 3 years prior to moving up here. And Jeff, you'd probably appreciate where I live. There's multiple breweries within,
yes.
I mean, less than a mile that you can just walk to anytime. Obviously not now, but hopefully again soon.
Yeah, no, I know one really good one in Columbus called Hoofhearted. And if I lived in Columbus, that would be my second home for sure.
That is literally like 3 blocks from me.
As soon as this travel ban is lifted, I'm coming out.
Yes. So I made the leap out to Ohio, which was a big one for me because, you know, my entire family lives out in New Jersey. So it was kind of hard to be the only one living out of state, but it was a great opportunity. And I viewed it really as the next step for me. So sure. I was the hospital director for MedVet Cincinnati. I was there for about 3 years. And while I was leading the Cincinnati hospital, a couple of other opportunities came up along the way, so I was able to manage and lead Cincinnati while also having the opportunity to manage our Dallas and Grapevine, Texas hospitals. So I was,
wow.
Yeah, that's really where the travel started.
That's quite a commute.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Only a few thousand miles, right?
Jeez.
So I was flying down and supporting the Dallas and Grapevine hospitals on a weekly to biweekly basis. And I did that for, I think it was about 6 months. And then as that was wrapping up, they offered me the opportunity to then start covering Cincinnati and Chicago. And Chicago is one of my absolute favorite cities. So I didn't hesitate. I went out there and covered Chicago. We thought it was going to be a pretty short-term thing, but it ended up being weekly trips for about a year, which was, it was a lot of work, but it was, I think, one of the most rewarding experiences of my career. I definitely learned a lot throughout the process.
Wow. You know, two things jump out at me while you were going through that is, Did you ever feel like, you know, specifically the two things that stuck out to me that you mentioned when you were at the hospital in New Jersey and you went from managing the ER to more managing all of the departments, the GP, the ER, and then also when you were in Ohio and you were commuting, you know, down to Dallas, did you ever feel along the way like you might be stretching yourself a little too thin? Like, did that register then, or did it ever really manifest that, or that actually ended up being okay?
I would say that I felt it more when I was in New Jersey. I think that there was always a little bit of a sense of guilt, right? So you're supporting a team of 65 to 70 and you're one person, and it's really hard when there's no middle management. You feel like you can't be clinically present enough. You can't give everyone the time that they need. And for me, that's more the piece that took a toll versus really the traveling.
Sure. And when you take two jobs and combine them, you know, two full-time jobs, I'm guessing, and combine it into one person then doing both of those jobs. I mean, we talked with David Liss about this, the same kind of thing, you know, having he mentioned like having the right people in the right seat, or at least having enough seats available for people to fill and not, you know, not just getting so stretched out. And that sounds like quite a challenge.
It was. And I credit the practice a bit because I think they've made some changes and they've learned from that. It was hard, but I do credit a lot of what I've learned to that practice. Definitely grown a lot since then. And I've learned a lot of what to do and also what not to do to make the team and the middle level management feel supported.
Gotcha.
So what is your role at MedVet right now?
Currently, I'm the VP of Clinical Services. So I support nine hospitals across five states.
Wow.
That is soon going to change. I'm transitioning down to six.
But, down to six?
Yeah.
just six.
You're downsizing, I like.
Yeah, it'll be a piece of cake. So I'm currently over some of our hospitals in Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and then I take a leap down and cover the Gulf Coast, so Louisiana and Alabama as well.
Wow.
But eventually that will be transitioned off, so it'll just be some of Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, so all driving distance.
Okay. And then what kind of support is it that you lend? Like, what kind of role do you serve? Like, do you go in and do training or an education? Do you go in and do evaluations, or what kind of things do you do there?
Yeah, so I really support and lead the hospital director. So each location has a hospital director that really leads the clinical services team. And we classify that as all non-doctors, non-support staff team members. So all of our assistants, our credential technicians, our BTSs all fall into clinical services. So I'm really the support system for the hospital director. So mentoring, developing, making sure that the hospital has what they need to deliver great patient care, making sure that the team has what they need to be successful and make it a career. So it's a lot of growth, a lot of development, and then obviously making sure that we are growing in a sustainable manner for our team so that we can, you know, be here providing care in 15, 20 years.
Gotcha. And then do you take, you know, any information, like if they feel like they're lacking in a certain area, or they need more help in a certain area, do you have the autonomy to give them those resources? Then do you take it to, you know, somebody else, and then they kind of look at that practice and authorize, you know, changes or what have you?
Yeah, I would say that we're able to make a lot of the decisions with the hospital directors. I have three peers across the organization. We collaborate a fair amount, but we do make the decisions. We have a lot of support services like IT, HR, operations that, you know, they're really great consultants and help to advise on a lot of the things that, you know, as credential technicians, we really don't know a lot, or at least I didn't know a lot about inventory management or, you know, all those things that come along with the territory.
Sure.
So we make our own decisions, but ultimately I lean a lot on our support services because really they're the subject matter experts.
Gotcha. Mm.
How do you balance your job with MedVet with East Coast Veterinary Education? Do they work together, or is East Coast Veterinary Education something completely separate that doesn't really play a role in MedVet?
It is. It's pretty separate. Admittedly, you know, with this role and everything that's been going on, I have not been able to dedicate as much time as I'd like to ECVE, but I'm hoping that we'll reach a stable point soon and be able to invest some more time in that.
Sure. So, you know, kind of going back through your different positions that you've had, was there anything along the way that you think, like, or that you can kind of go back to that really kind of sparked your fire with mental health and kind of going down, you know, looking into more certifications and drawing more of an interest in that? Or was it just kind of a gradual thing and you just kind of ended up there?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. There's some personal factors and some professional factors that really led me down this path. And, you know, I think this is, to your point earlier, a really somber topic that I do feel like we all try to avoid and we don't want to talk about it. But I think for me, there was always this desire to really try and normalize it and remove the stigma of, you know, just because you're suffering from a mental illness doesn't make you less than the person that's not.
Sure.
And doesn't mean that you shouldn't be able to talk about those things. And just in the interest of being completely open, I'll share my story with you guys a little bit. I've not broadly socialized it, but, you know, I lost my cousin to suicide in May of 2006, and we're approaching the 14-year anniversary, though it feels like it was yesterday. You know, I remember waking up and hearing my parents take that phone call from my aunt and uncle. And, you know, time has passed, but the impact really hasn't. It will always be with me, and I think has helped to, you know, shape me both personally and professionally a bit. As you guys know, many of our colleagues that we know mutually within the industry really struggle with mental health, including myself at one point, and we can talk a little bit more about that. And then with where we're going as an industry, the suicide rate is just alarming to me, that with the trend that we're identifying. And, you know, it hits home for me because I've experienced that on a personal level. And now, you know, like good colleagues of ours, like Louise O'Dwyer, when she passed, I think that was, it was devastating. So for me, I really wanted to try and normalize this and make it a topic that we feel a little bit more comfortable discussing and really trying to make a difference. And for me, it takes one person to be able to do that.
Joe, going through the compassion fatigue education, is there an institution that you go to get that kind of certification, or how does that work?
Yeah, so there were, I went through two different programs. One was through the Green Cross Academy of Traumatology. That was an online program. It was really all recorded lectures. You got to work at your own pace. I felt that I had to go a little bit slower because there was really a lot of information that I wanted to absorb along the way.
Sure.
And then the Certified Compassion Fatigue Professional was through the International Association of Trauma Professionals. Similarly, they were recorded lectures. That one, you had to take a certifying exam at the end. I think it was like 50 or 60 questions. And then the renewal period is every 1 to 3 years, depending on how much CE you complete in between.
Is that something, maybe I don't know when in terms of timeline this happened, but is this something like MedVet or was really supportive of, or had you already had this when you were kind of starting out there and... Or something you kind of brought to them?
I had it in progress before I joined. I was admittedly a little bit slow to get it done. But then they started really a mental health initiative and focused a lot on wellness and well-being. And that kind of triggered me that, you know, maybe it was time for me to drive it across the finish line.
Just kind of dovetailed in right in there. And that sounds great. When we talk about compassion fatigue, we were doing an interview very recently, and one of our guests was telling their story, and I was very much relating to it, just, you know, listening to her talk about some of the signs. What are some of the common signs when we talk about compassion fatigue for people listening, whether they're worried about whether or not it's something they're going through or a coworker might be going through? What kind of things would we want to be looking out for?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's important to differentiate a little bit between compassion fatigue and burnout before you can really identify those. I think they're used synonymously, but they're not really interchangeable. So compassion fatigue really being that physical or emotional result that's created really from the trauma of helping others. So really you're taking on their emotional burden. And we see that in veterinary medicine. You know, think about euthanasias where you empathize with the client so much that sometimes you take on the burden as if it's your own. Where burnout would be more of stressors in the work environment. So, you know, we've all worked in a practice where maybe the culture isn't exactly where we want it, and there's a lot of interpersonal conflict. Maybe there's financial instability. We know that exists across the industry, really. So one is more about taking on the burden, while the other is more about the stressors in the work environment. But compassion fatigue is really comprised of two different components. It's secondary traumatic stress, also known as vicarious trauma, which is essentially just taking that burden on as your own, and burnout. So burnout does play a role in compassion fatigue, but you can also be burned out without having compassion fatigue. So they can go together or separately.
So you can have one or the other or both.
Yeah.
I'm thinking back to the times where I feel like, you know, I thought I was dealing with compassion fatigue, but now that you explain it that way, it sounds more like I was experiencing burnout. When we are feeling this, and when we feel like we're going down this path, I remember that time and thinking that I just needed to get out. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to fix it. Like I knew the problem was there. I recognized the problem, but I didn't know what to do to fix it or how to get away from it. So what advice would you give to techs right now that think they might be experiencing either burnout or compassion fatigue to try to get themselves out of that cycle? What's the best thing for them to do?
You know, I think it depends where you are in that process and how soon you catch it. I think reaching out for help is always, for me, the first recommendation. There's a lot of resources available, and I always encourage my team to use the resources. A lot of organizations will provide things like employee assistance programs or EAPs that are really confidential, in many cases, complementary resources that employers provide that go through things like financial well-being, mental well-being, physical well-being. And I know that there's always the question of, do they report this back to my employer? Is my manager going to find out? And, you know, the honest answer is no, I don't find out about any of those things, nor do I want to. But I do want to foster the type of relationship where when my team's in that place, they feel like they can come to me and talk to me about it, which I do feel like is something that we sometimes miss the mark on in veterinary medicine from a leadership perspective.
Yeah, I think it, you know, part of that goes back to sometimes in hospital settings, people get promoted into management or leadership roles that are almost by default because they've been there, you know, the longest time, that maybe they don't even necessarily have an interest in it, but, you know, they can manage inventory or they can run a budget or what have you. But
or they just know how the hospital runs.
Or they just know how the hospital runs. And sometimes with some of this stuff, you know, especially if they're not given any tools to have additional training or encouraged to do so, if it's something that they want to do, you know, then the people that are, you know, the rest of the staff that was working at that hospital then is, you know, stuck in that cycle. And that is something that is just so prevalent in our industry. Thinking to like a veterinary technician or any staff member really that might be experiencing this, like, and it probably again kind of goes back to where they are in that cycle, like how difficult is it to kind of come back from that? I mean, do you kind of have to take some time away, or is a matter of recognizing it and talking about it, and are there actual ways that they can kind of come back from it still in that position that they hold?
Yeah, I think one thing in terms of identifying where you are, there is something called a professional quality of life scale, or ProQual. It's really the standard measure for compassion fatigue. A lot of people don't know that it exists, but it's actually a free tool that anyone can download online. It's 30 questions. So you go through and rate each question on a scale of 1 to 5. Most of them are, I believe it's like strongly agree to strongly disagree. And that will go through and measure 3 different categories. So it'll measure your compassion satisfaction, your burnout, and then your secondary traumatic stress. Remembering that compassion fatigue is really equivalent to burnout plus secondary traumatic stress. You know, I don't hear the term compassion satisfaction talked about a lot. And in my opinion, it's something that's incredibly important for us to talk more about. Because when you introduce compassion satisfaction, it's really the opposite of compassion fatigue. So what are the things that really fill your bucket and fulfill you every day? Sure. And identifying where are they? And they exist in the workplace and they exist outside of work. So, you know, a lot of team members really enjoy client education, or some enjoy, you know, providing that nursing care and then reuniting the pet with their owner and seeing that moment that they connect. For me, it's really seeing team members grow and learn from mistakes and continue excelling. So identifying first what fills your bucket and trying to figure out how can you get more of that to reduce your compassion fatigue, or try and eliminate it.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I've never heard the term compassion satisfaction.
I haven't either. That's a very, very interesting idea. I mean, I've definitely heard of, you know, filling your bucket and different things, but that's a really, really interesting idea. So in a leadership role like what you're in, what kind of advice would you give for somebody listening, say, that maybe is a practice leader, practice manager, head technician, et cetera, that maybe is worried about one of their employees? From that perspective, how do you approach somebody that you might be worried about that might be experiencing that?
So I prefer having those direct conversations with the team members, recognizing that, you know, I've been in their shoes, so I know how vulnerable you have to be to really be in a place to talk about it. But, you know, even if it's just sharing with them the resources, or just checking in to see if they're okay, or if there's anything that you can do for them, I think this is part of a bigger picture of, you know, really team rounding and getting to know your team so that you instinctively know when something's wrong.
Right.
And then in doing so, you have that relationship to be able to have the conversation. But, you know, providing like the EAP resource, and maybe they need some time off. Maybe you need to look further into, you know, I think that we sometimes minimize the value of taking a break regularly and what that can do for well-being and their mental health, it's not overrated. So also going down the path of looking at what are the risk factors in the workplace, and do you see them in your hospital? Or from the employee standpoint, you know, do you see them, and are there things that you can do to make a positive change as well? Things that I think contribute to compassion fatigue, but sometimes we don't necessarily connect the dots on, are think about training programs. And I think they're quite variable across hospitals. And sometimes we train team members for 2 days, and then, you know, there's such a dire need on the schedule that we put them on the schedule and they're off on their own.
Right.
And then, you know, a couple of days later, we're wondering, why are they making so many mistakes? Why don't they know our processes? And, you know, the ownership really falls on us. But if you really think about how they feel, they're probably feeling a little bit helpless. They're making mistakes, which may be something new for them. And really, through this process, they probably have less compassion satisfaction than they want and that we want them to have. And we know that when your compassion satisfaction goes down, you're going to have some sort of fallout from that, right? So burnout or compassion fatigue. So, you know, making sure that you set your teams up for success with the tools that they need. Camaraderie, being one with your team. And we were working in ER together, and I had back-to-back euthanasias. We know how emotionally challenging that can be. So, you know, reaching out to your coworkers for help and asking them, hey, do you think you can step in on this one and support me here? You know, I don't think that any of us would ever reach out to a colleague and the answer would be no, especially if we knew the emotional toll.
That's true. We had a study that we posted, this was a while back, about the factors that led to burnout, where we talked about the ratio of nurse to patient and some of the other things that led to burnout. Did you read that study at all that was floating around Facebook for a while?
That was about the patient ratio?
Yeah.
Yes. I have not read it in a while, but okay, I did read it. Staffing plays a role in it. Resources also plays a role in it. So, you know, if you're on the floor and you don't have the supplies or the medications or equipment you need to deliver patient care, that's going to play a role in your compassion satisfaction as well.
Right. Yeah.
Do you find very often, because when I think about some of these stressors or some of these outside influences, if you will, to new staff or to staff that have been there for a while, I can see how almost an entire staff unit could start to become affected by something like this, rather than, you know, an individual person. And maybe it manifests itself differently in different people. But do you ever find a situation where, you know, it's multiple people on the same team that are kind of going through this, and maybe they're actually feeding it to each other a little bit, or is that something that doesn't really happen?
No, I think it does. And, you know, I see, from my experience, I've seen the most compassion fatigue in emergency medicine. They go hand in hand for me, really, because of the things that are walking through the door and, you know, the chronic euthanasias that have to be performed. I do think that when I see it across a department, sometimes it's more of a burnout piece. And I do think that there's a cultural component there too of, you know, we need to be the ones to create this culture. And I know that this is maybe a little bit controversial, but the thought process that the manager needs to be the one to create the great culture, but truly it's up to all of us to create the culture that we want to work in. And then when we get down the path of a negative culture, that's what starts to lead into things like burnout. And then with burnout being a factor in compassion fatigue, we end up in that place. And, you know, we've all worked in a hospital at one point or another where it's toxic, right? So everyone's burned out. No one wants to work. They feel like they're understaffed. And, you know, in some cases they are. So it's that chronic feeling.
Just thinking in terms of more of your role at MedVet as opposed to your role as a compassion fatigue educator, if you have an employee that you realize is going through this, either burnout or compassion fatigue or both, what's the process for that to get them out of that situation? Do they get moved to a different team? Do they get moved out of that situation? Do they get some time off? What's the plan for them? How do you fix that as a hospital administrator, not necessarily as a compassion fatigue professional?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it depends a little bit on the underlying factors of it. Right. You know, I'm always a little bit hesitant to just pick somebody up and move them to another schedule or another department. Mm-hmm. My worry there is there an underlying cause of this? And are we not getting to the root of it? And we're just going to be back in the same place with another team member in a couple of weeks or months. But if it's truly like, you know, there's lifetime ER team members that it comes to a point when, you know, maybe they want to transition to another department. And, you know, I would be fully supportive of that. And we are always try to accommodate when a team member needs time away. There are resources like FMLA, compassion leave, things that we can grant them time off for, because we want to prioritize their well-being. And the phrases that always stick out to me are, you can't pour from an empty cup. So, you know, we need to give our team members time to recharge. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to take care of their colleagues or the patients or clients.
Right. That's, I mean, that's something that, you know, I don't know how new this concept is, but you know, if I was dealing with that back when I was dealing with burnout, I probably would still be there, but I don't think we had that available to us at that point. So it's amazing that you guys are doing that and allowing to put the employees first to make sure that they're healthy and make sure that their well-being is taken care of before we're worried about our bottom line and worried about how many patients are coming in the door and things like that. I think that's amazing.
When we talk about these ideas, compassion fatigue and burnout, for somebody that may believe they're not going through it, are there steps that they can take or steps that a hospital or a team can take to actively try to prevent, you know, a team member or anybody on their team or an individual from kind of going through that? Like, what kind of recommendations do you have for people that aren't in that state but realize that it's, you know, a possibility and want to be proactive with their mental health and kind of avoid that if they can?
Yeah, one thing that I would recommend is for everyone to take the professional quality of life test and to see where you are. And, you know, the thing is, you shouldn't take it when you're in that emotional place where, you know, it's just going to be a reactionary response. But,
sure,
you know, try to get a baseline on where you are and what areas of opportunity there are for you. It'll help you to tailor a little bit of what you need to do and what you need to focus on. But, you know, the number one recommendation that I would make is prioritize your well-being and prioritize yourself. I think it's really hard for us to do because we always want to be there for the team and for our patients. And, you know, we feel like we need to pick up every single shift because if I don't do it, who is going to do it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why we don't take breaks. That's why we
do. Yeah, and that's, yeah, they don't take, no one takes breaks. You feel like you can't disconnect when, right, you leave the building. I will say that trying to develop transition habits, so figuring out how you can leave work at work versus taking it home with you, I think that's a big one. When you're at work, taking breaks, you know, that's, again, the piece of, we don't want to leave the floor, or if we take a break now, we're going to be here longer at the end of the day.
Well, and Jeff always likes to say, this is Jeff's word of advice, is the work will be there when you get back from lunch, so don't skip out on your lunch.
Yeah, I mean, 30 minutes is not going to make or break, right, and if it does, exactly, I think there's bigger problems to solve.
That's probably true.
I think the other piece, I mean, this is pretty, it might sound pretty basic, but something that we might overlook sometimes is really the importance of regular physical activity. So, you know, going home and whether it's taking a walk, going for a run, or whatever the physical activity is that you prefer. Running has always been something that, I mean, I'm pretty out of shape now and don't do it much, but, you know, that was always how I disconnected. I would go for a run, you know, I'd process the day as I was running, and then I'd get home and I'd feel a little bit more disconnected. But following that up with balanced nutrition, I admittedly am a stress eater, so... You know, I'm trying to get better at that, and really balancing the physical activity and the nutrition piece together are incredibly important for your well-being.
Yeah. And, you know, when you work however many hours a day on the floor and however many days in a row, you know, you start getting into bad eating habits and bad exercise habits. It's all just a vicious cycle, it sounds like.
Well, and then you say, I'll take care of it when I'm done with this stretch, and then that stretch never ends, and then you're still, yeah, in that same cycle, and you just kind of follow down that path.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned a little earlier on, Joe, kind of your story and you know, some of the challenges you faced. How did you kind of work your way back from some of that? You know, any personal advice that you would kind of give to people that are listening?
Yeah, I struggled for quite some time. There was a point in my career that I admittedly was worried that I needed to leave clinical practice because I just wasn't sure that I would be able to rebound from the place that I was in. Mm-hmm. I did take a couple of weeks off and just tried to disconnect from work and disconnect and really just focus on me. One thing that was really important for me is, you know, I'm sure you guys know Jenny Fisher. She coined the phrase, surrounding yourself with your tribe. So finding the people, mm-hmm, that can really recognize and relate to what you're going through and try to help you through it. And, you know, we all have a lot of connections in the industry and some are closer than others, but I reached out to the people that I knew would understand what I'm going through and be able to provide me with feedback. And, you know, some of it wasn't easy to hear. It wasn't about reaching out to the people that, you know, I know they're going to tell me exactly what I want. Some of them had to give me some hard feedback about things that I needed to change.
Yeah.
And until I could come to terms with, you know, the ownership that I had in it, I wasn't able to move forward. But so I disconnected from work. I did start focusing a little bit more on myself. You know, it's hard because you get in that place of you want to finish the work all in one day, and you end up working 14, 16 hour days, 5 days a week, and it's not sustainable long term. So I disconnected for a while, and I thought about, you know, what are the options? Where are my passions? Spent some time with the people that understood what I was going through, got to go out and visit my family on the East Coast, which for me brings a lot of fun and a lot of excitement. So, and then when I finally went back into clinical practice, I mean, it was only a couple of weeks in between, but I felt refreshed and I felt recharged. And, you know, I had to make some difficult changes along the way. And the advice that I would give everyone is sometimes you do have to make difficult decisions and hard changes, but you have to look at, what does this mean long term? Make the short-term sacrifices so that your long-term well-being is intact.
I know this is something we brought up a couple episodes ago, maybe more than a couple episodes ago. There was a veterinarian that wrote an article basically denying that compassion fatigue was a thing, or that it just didn't exist. I think the phrase that she used was that, I'm a veterinarian, my compassion never runs out. So what would you say to people that kind of deny it or who don't believe in compassion fatigue?
You know, I think that we are all very evidence-based individuals. Yes. We love science, and there's a lot of data out there around compassion fatigue. There's a lot of data out there around suicide in the veterinary industry. And, you know, I think that sometimes getting people on board with this, they view it as like it's philosophical and it will never happen to me. I'm stronger than that. And sure. Trying to maybe educate them a little bit would be helpful, but I do feel like there's going to be people that are just resistant to the thought of it at all. And, you know, that's a little bit for me where it comes down to having to make that difficult decision. If there's an employer that you go to them and you need help or support or guidance, and you're struggling with your well-being, and the answer is compassion fatigue doesn't exist and you just have to get over it. You know, I think that's big. And I think that's when it comes down to, is this right for me? Right. And going back to that place of prioritizing your own well-being again.
Yeah, I would say the same. I mean, if that was the response, it would be a very difficult decision.
Yeah.
Actually, probably a very easy decision, but, you know, the idea of finding another place to work. You know, with everything that's going on right now with COVID-19 and all that, hospitals are changing in so many different ways, whether that's no longer being elective or curbside check-in, risk of exposure and donating supplies and maybe lack of PPE. And I can see these problems being even more magnified or more prevalent through this process. Is that something that you're seeing amongst any of your teams? Is that out there, or maybe just people more recognizing it more, or really not any different currently?
I do think it's a little bit more magnified at this point. You know, we're all very in tune with what's going on. We all, you know, are probably on social media. We watch the news, and, you know, it's kind of hard to disconnect from the reality of what we're going through. I think that tied with, you know, we've seen the memes on social media about this being the 50th process change that's happening in, you know, a 2-day period. And it's hard. It really is hard for the team to adjust and adapt that quickly. So I do recognize that plays a component in it. You know, a lot of hospitals are changing over to teams or pods, which maybe is changing the staffing model a little bit, which is stressful. And then there's also the economic piece of it. So we have clients that, you know, the unemployment rate, I don't know, nationwide it's at 4.5% or 5%, which is incredibly up from where we were.
Yeah.
So now we have a lot of clients that, unfortunately, you know, they're not going to be able to afford care. So it's going to put our team in the position of potentially having to euthanize more patients and go through that process more often than we'd really like to.
So at Tufts, we have a licensed social worker on staff. And that person is more, I think they were brought on in a capacity to really be there for the clients that are, you know, grieving with euthanasias or struggling with financial decisions and so on and so forth. And I think now that he's been there a couple of years, he's really kind of starting to interact more with the staff. And we've talked to a couple of other people that work at clinics where social workers are on staff. Is that something you see, you know, is that something that MedVet does? I know that probably is a great resource for people that actually work at those clinics, but is that something you have very much experience with?
I have not personally worked in a practice that has or had a licensed clinical social worker, but I do know that our West Vet Hospital out in Boise, they either had or have one currently, and they have found it to be a great resource.
I think
it's becoming a little bit more and more prevalent as we start recognizing what kind of issues we're facing as an industry.
Yeah, I know the one that's on our staff, he came to the vet school after having been in working in human hospitals for like 25 years. But every year now he has a social worker intern, and they're more specializing in veterinary social work. So it's definitely something that becoming, hopefully, you know, again, as years go by, and again, this becomes more of a normal, again, air quotes, kind of thing, that, you know, it's actually a reality. Hopefully that's just another resource that more and more people will have access to, because I think it can be, you know, really, really, really beneficial. So,
yeah, and I know that there's just a little bit of hesitation for some practices to execute on hiring a full-time social worker, you know, there are resources out there that can do like focus groups on site and things like that. So it doesn't have to be all or nothing. You can kind of layer the resource in.
Yeah. And I can say too, my wife's hospital, kind of an odd idea, but they actually share, if you will, a social worker. They have three or four clinics that they kind of rotate through, if you will. And so while that person isn't necessarily full-time at her clinic, she has full-time access to them via email and so on and so forth. But they actually split time, maybe just one day a week at a few different hospitals. So that might be, you know, an avenue that somebody could pursue too. So really, really interesting stuff. And I hope that becomes, again, a more prevalent resource for people down the road.
Yes, for sure.
You know, kind of thinking as we're going to wrap up here in the next minute or two, Joe, is there anything else you want to convey that we haven't touched on yet in terms of compassion fatigue or recognizing it or dealing with it, or, you know, advice you want to give out to anybody and, you know, kind of come to mind or that you want to touch on?
Yeah, I think the key takeaways for me would be to know what resources are available to you. So things like EAPs, National Suicide Prevention Hotlines. There is Not One More Vet support staff support group out there on Facebook that is an outstanding resource. And then really helping to break the stigma of that having a mental illness or not being in a great place, that there's something wrong with that. Support your colleagues. Be kind and judgment free, right? Like,
be
there for your team members when they need you the most. And when you need them, they're going to be there for you too.
And then,
I mean, really just remembering that it takes one person to make a big change when it comes to well-being.
Yeah.
And that's great advice.
If somebody comes to you and, you know, is in a bad spot, really measure your response, because, you know, that can have a profound effect either way, good or bad. And
well, that's one of the hard things too, is that as that person that you want to be there for them to lean on and to come to you for advice, you know, if you don't have access to the tools or don't have the information, like some of the stuff that you say may actually be more harmful than not saying anything. Knowing the right things to say, I think is really important. And I think that's why we need to use these resources, even as people that are not going through compassion fatigue or burnout. Just being able to be aware of what you should be saying to people that are experiencing this to make it easier for them. And then also that's going to put more trust in you from that person to make them rely on you and actually help them get through it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think to your point of knowing what to say, there's a lot of training programs out there for this type of thing, one of which is QPR gatekeeper training, which really walks you through what do you do and what do you say if you feel like a team member is in that place of maybe thinking about hurting themselves. So I do think that's a good point to bring up for sure.
Yeah, I think it was actually Liza.
Yeah, it was Liza.
About that. Yeah.
And I was going to do that, but, you know, stuff gets in the way and
life happened.
Life happens.
But we'll have to link that up again.
We'll link it up again. We'll put all these things on the link. I just pulled up the ProQOL. This is really
important. Yeah, I didn't know that existed. After a few days off, I would like to take that myself and see what it looks like and see, because I have concerns.
Yeah, you might be surprised by the results.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, Joe, we want to thank you so much for taking some time out and talking to us about all of this stuff. I know it's not easy subjects, but it's very important subjects. And I, you know, like you said, you kind of talked about some of your personal experiences. And, you know, Dave and I, we started this podcast because we've kind of been down this road a little bit as well. And there are so many people that I worry about that, you know, are they there? Have they been there? Are they going to be able to work their way back? And hopefully just hearing that actually it is really quite common. And like you said, removing that stigma that going through something like that is as normal as not going through something like that and never having to deal with it. And that's okay. And we really appreciate you taking some time.
And not just hearing it from Joe, but also those resources that we're going to be able to post on the links for our show notes. I think those are going to be super helpful for people as well.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing that with us. That's been amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for having me tonight.
And, well, you're not done yet.
You're not done yet. We're going to change the tone a little bit and try to at least have one or two good laughs before we before we head out. So
which one you think, Jeff? One, two, or three?
Does it involve potato water?
No, it does not.
No, but if you had some handy, you would be free to drink it at this point.
Do you want to let Joe pick it? We can let Joe pick it. I like all these questions. Joe, yeah. What do you want? One, two, or three?
Oh, boy. Let's go with two.
With two. Okay. So your Vet Tech Cafe, would you rather question? Are you ready for it?
Oh, boy. I don't know.
Okay. Here we go. Would you rather be famous when you are alive, but then forgotten when you're dead? Or be an unknown when you're alive, but famous after you're dead? And why?
I would like to be famous after I'm dead. I'm a pretty, to be honest, a pretty introverted person, so I don't like a lot of the spotlight to ever be on me.
I think we're going to have three of the exact same answers,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
So the thought of like the spotlight being on me right now is just horrifying.
Well, that's why it's a podcast, and it's audio, not video.
Yeah, this is good, but yes. Fame in real life, no.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we're all in the same boat, I guess.
Absolutely.
The same reason, right?
Yeah. And that virtual cup of coffee joke can absolutely be champagne. Nobody's ever going to know.
No one will know.
Might be where I'm headed.
Well, thank you again so much for your time. And like I said, we'll get all these links up with the episode when it releases. And, you know, hopefully, I mean, I know people out there are really going to relate to this, and it's going to resonate with them, because if they're not battling it, they know somebody that is. I mean, honestly, in my mind, that's just where the profession is at, unfortunately. Yeah. And like you said, just removing the stigma, and the more we talk about it, the more normal it becomes that people are actually experiencing this, and then we can just kind of move forward.
And the more help they're going to get. If the stigma's gone, there's no stigma with asking for help, which I think is one of the big important things.
Anyway, again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Joe.
And hopefully, you know, it's late April now. Hopefully by September, we can think about IVEX and
Some potato water.
Yeah, share some potato water and a couple laughs and stories. And if not, hopefully we'll get to see you sometime soon.
Yeah.
But again, thank you so much for coming and having a cup of coffee at the Vet Tech Cafe. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you both.
Have a good night, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Dave and Jeff would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As we talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by Dave, Jeff, or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have any questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.